You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
As mentioned, our shapeshifter today is Nene Molefe, the owner and CEO of Mandate Molefe HR Consultant, who specializes around culture change, diversity, equity and inclusion, transformation, and so much more. She is an experienced consultant and facilitator with a track record that spans over 20 years. She has facilitated dialogue sessions for numerous boards and executive committees on a variety of for interventions, including alignment of boards and exco committees. And Nene has also worked with a number of private schools on unconscious bias and diversity and inclusion strategies. And it gives me such great pleasure to be talking to her this evening. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening, and to all your listeners.
Ah, how are you today?
I'm great. Feeling awesome.
Fantastic. And how was your day?
Oh, busy as usual.
Okay.
But busy good, busy good.
Ah, I see. I always hear people saying that busy is good. So I'm not sure if it is. But if you're saying busy is good, then I'm going to take your word for it.
No, there's sometimes busy bad.
Yes.
Good. So today was busy good.
Yeah. Busy good. Hey, am I still allowed to say Happy New Year? I know we are 11 days
yes,
in,
you
but
are.
Happy New Year. Yeah. Oh, I see.
Happy New Year to you.
I'm going to be saying Happy New Year to you until that date, like every
yes,
day. Happy
until
New
the
Year.
31st.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Happy New Year to you, ma'am. We wish you all the best for the year 2024. And may God grant all the wishes. Someone challenged me when we started the year and they said, well, you know how we dub different years, right? So apparently 2024 is dubbed 2020 Saw.
Okay.
So we have to soar like eagles this year. I was like, ha! Such pressure,
okay.
Though.
Okay. No, claim it, you will get it.
I should claim it and I will get it, eh?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes,
well,
yes.
I think I've claimed it because where do I start? I mean, you are my first shapeshifter for the year and goodness me, we've set the standard very high. So my producer now shouldn't go down. Like she should just keep going up and up because what a way to start the year, man. We really appreciate your time this
so
evening.
Much.
For people who may not know you, follow you, please tell us a little bit about yourself. And I know that sounds like a very weird question every time many people ask you. Please tell us a little bit about yourself. But please indulge us just this time around.
I know. My name is Nini Molefe. Nini is really a nickname. I am Kehomudi.
Oh, okay.
Molefe, funny enough, Nini comes from Yvonne, you know.
Oh.
But anyway. So I was born in Soweto, matriculated at Meadowlands High School.
Yeah.
And what's important, I always say this because when I publish my book, I say this in my book as well.
Yeah.
That one of the defining moments in my life as I was growing up, when I was 16, my mother died, right?
Ah, I see.
And I was instant at 9, what they call grade 11 now.
Sure, yeah.
But let me tell you something that for me is significant, and I live by that even now. After she had died, between that and the day of the burial, we were writing exams.
Ooh.
So I had to go and write.
Sure.
Because, you know, she would always say, my mother was an entrepreneur, she used to sell clothes.
Yeah.
She will always say, despite what you are going through, persevere.
Sure.
Show up in the best way you can.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And I remember that actually I stood up, I went to write because I was left with only two subjects and to throw all that away.
Yes, yes.
So then I grew up and then I went to University of Fort Hare.
Okay.
I studied social work at University of Fort Hare. And then I went to UCT to do my postgrad at UCT.
Okay.
And then I also went to York St. John's University in the UK.
Yeah.
To do my master's, but that I did while I was working. And then I worked for my very first job was I was the first black social worker for the Red Cross Hospital in Cape Town.
Yes.
And then after that went to work for Eskom.
Yeah.
For many years. I worked for Eskom for about 10 years.
Okay.
And then went to the, I was seconded by Eskom to Department of Labor.
Yeah.
So I headed HR when we were developing all the new pieces of legislation, the basic conditions, Labor Relations Act and all that.
Yeah.
Then after that, went to the city. My last formal employment was I was the executive director for the city of Cape Town.
For the city of Cape Town.
Yeah, and then in my own business from there on.
Fantastic. There's a lot to chew just on what you mentioned. But let's go back to Soweto. Where in Soweto? Because I'm from Soweto as well.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm from Dube.
Dube. I see. Yeah. I see. Yeah. Did you used to use those train stations there by Pefeni?
Oh, yes.
No,
not Sako Pefen, go Dube Station.
Dube Station. Okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
Dube Station once, yeah.
That's
in fact, when I studied at Meadowlands High School, we would go, my transport was from Dube Station.
I see. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I grew up in Soweto, so I know the cultural and socioeconomic, situation of Soweto and all that. I've actually lived in Dobsonville. I've lived in the now called Snake Park, there as well, and I've also lived Kozola 3. I was actually did my schooling in Kozola 3, so as a pantsula, I still am, I always tell people, hey, as much as I may sound bougie or look bougie, I'm a pantsula at heart,
We used to call you guys, really,
exactly.
So now we were staying Kozola closer to town.
No, you guys were like the posh people, you guys had things easy. So now we're benefiting. Zola 3, imagine.
Funny how even our mindset, we used to divide ourselves.
Exactly.
All
so, yeah.
Yeah.
So what are the challenges that you could see from a socio-economic point of view in Dube specifically? And how did that influence your outlook in life?
Yeah, I must tell you, one of the things, and maybe it comes back to what you said.
Yeah.
What I used to appreciate, we used to be one of the only or first or few townships in Soweto that had a library.
Yeah, right?
And then 76 or even 77, the library was burned, I think, or much later, in fact, about the 80s.
Yeah.
But we used to have a library. So the discipline of reading,
yes.
I mean, that library, would be packed, and kids would go, and it used to be the most beautiful thing to watch. What I wish and hope is that, like, many townships would have had that, because whether we like it or not, there's a lot. I often say, when I teach in these the executives in many organizations, I often say, good leaders read. Great leaders read a lot. If you don't read, even if I'm as qualified as whatever the many degrees that I have, I constantly have to be improving myself by reading and hearing what other people who came before me, and that's how you actually develop yourself. So I'm going back to when I talk about socioeconomic conditions in our township, we must look at it parallel to the fact that as individuals, we also have resources to be able to develop ourselves. There are kids with passion. There are kids who want to make it, who want to advance, but they don't have the means, they don't have the resources. So I'm just hoping that now even our government will realize that there's certain things that are needed in our townships for communities to thrive.
Definitely. So I suppose, coming from the posh parts of Soweto, and with a library and reading, they say library is like radio. You know how radio is the theater of the mind, where you just imagine these things. But I'm sure a book did that for you, and you could see a better you, a better South Africa.
Because when people, like, when you read, when you are sitting and people are arguing, even now I tell people educate yourself so that when you're sitting even around the corners, be the one who will offer people a different perspective. Did you know what is happening? Did you know this and this? Know what is happening around you. Don't just say, I'm not interested, when you're living in the same kind of community. Self-development and personal development, the work that I do in companies, I say, yes, it's a responsibility of the organization to ensure that there's a budget and all that, but it's your responsibility to ensure that you take interest in your personal development and growth. Nobody can do it for you.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. And what were young people like? What did they struggle with around Dube?
At the time, the struggle, really, I must say, throughout the whole of Soweto, the glue that brought us together
was apartheid.
It was. And there was a different type of unity, though, because it's like there was a vision. You know, when you have a common vision, when you have a common goal, it's like you're, because there isn't, I don't think there is that common goal.
There
people
isn't,
are doing a million different things. When there's a common goal, there is that sense of camaraderie. There is that sense of one day we will achieve, one day we will do that. So I think at the time we were really preoccupied around the fact that there's oppression. This is happening in townships, you know.
And I must say that, I mean, I often go back home, and it's true that it seems like that common camaraderie that you're talking about doesn't exist anymore because of that non-existent of that common goal. And you can see the fragmentation in the society, and you realize, sure, these walls that we've built have become literal walls, which back in the days weren't that much. First black social worker at Red Cross. You know, I always wonder what people who have experienced first black this and that feel. How did you feel being the first black social worker?
I felt it twice. Firstly, go both in Cape Town. Go to Cape Town and then earlier the Red Cross.
I
must tell you, at the Red Cross, you laugh at this. Like everybody was, because as a social worker, you are allocated to different wards, right? I was taking care of the burns unit and, you know, the different cancer unit at different wards. But then I would be, people would come and call me to be an interpreter. Like, there is no black social worker. So the some of the nurses and the doctors, I remember my supervisor saying, you know, she was a white Afrikaans woman, very good, very progressive. And she was saying, listen, she said in one staff meeting, there was a meeting between doctors, nurses, and social workers, occupational therapists. She was saying, listen, Nini went to university just like you.
Please.
She is not your interpreter. At that time, I thought I was helping them. Then they would call me, and then I end up sacrificing the work that I had to do in my ward. So it was just hilarious. And then she said, no, the hospital must employ more black social workers calling her. So I used to laugh at that. But but being the first, that's one of the sacrifices that you have to do about being the first. But also people, you know, there's that thing that people looking up to you, whether you succeed. It was more at the city of Cape Town where there I was in the executive committee, in the exco, you must remember. You know, being the very first African woman and the first woman, let alone African first woman, to sit at the exco. And everybody looks up to say, somebody who's coming to speak for us, somebody who's coming to solve our problems. And they don't know what you are sitting with in that exco meeting. They don't know things are difficult. And when things don't happen, they said, they're just sitting on positions, they're doing nothing. So, there's a lot. Always feel... I've got empathy and sympathy and all the feelings for people who are the first
It's not always easy. Did you feel some imposter syndrome while sitting there?
I don't know if I even did that. There was so much, let me tell you, the one pressure that was there. People were saying, she's coming from, you must remember I was coming from outside of Cape Town. At that time it was a big deal. Because I was coming from Johannesburg, right? Coming outside of Cape Town, almost like you are taking somebody from Joburg to impose her to come and be at the executive director level. So I was facing issues with regards to issues of race. When you've been long here in South Africa, you'll know those are there. But also issues of being outside of Cape Town. So I had to deal with so many things. Funny enough, I don't think imposter was one of them. I was just grappling with what is happening around me.
Sure.
But it was so, I must tell you, it was so heavy, I stayed 1 year.
Ah.
I left. I said, I'm going back home to my own
yo,
house.
Yo.
Yeah.
That's hectic.
It was not easy.
So what drew you, ma'am, to social work?
Do you know stories? Whoever parents that are listening here, it's important that what we say in our dinner tables when we're sitting in our homes and all that, stories that parents tell matter.
Yes, yes.
My mother used to say, I want to be a social worker. Ne?
Yeah.
And do you know what her, you laugh at what her reason was?
Yeah.
Is that social workers used to be the only profession that would give women cars. They used to drive those Volkswagen Beetles in the township.
Yes.
We used to say, wow, and most of them were social workers.
Ah.
So my mother said, I want you to be, so you see you have a car, you see you have this and this. And I actually became that.
Yes.
You know, I actually became a social worker.
And you drove that Beetle car?
Well, I didn't drive. My first car was a Volkswagen. Later I changed into leadership.
Yes,
and
yes.
Sources.
Yeah. Okay. And what do you think, ma'am, is the one challenge with, like, you know, our politicians like saying hindsight? I don't know where they get this thing, but they always like this hindsight. It's almost like it's a person who can go and take out of their wardrobe and bring her back and bring him back.
Yeah.
They always say with the benefit of hindsight, what's the one challenge you think you've faced? Is it working at the City of Cape Town with the challenges there? Or maybe this being the first black thing was a bit of a challenge. Yes, it had its own perks, but maybe that there were some challenges that you had to deal with.
Yes. No, it was definitely a challenge.
Yeah.
I must tell you, because it was the first ever employment where I didn't stay more than a year.
Yes, I see.
Because there was just too much pressure.
Yeah.
And you know, issues of mental health are serious. And when people go through mental health issues at work, I'm always very understanding, because I know that, especially if, let's say, this is not your home, this is not your country, or this is not your province, like me, I felt, you know, although Cape Town is in South Africa, but I felt like this is not home at that time. And there was the support system wasn't as strong. So it was difficult then. But the difficulty, maybe not so much in the community, but it was within the organization that I was working in. It was, remember, at the height of issues of change, you know, in the city council at that time, the DA and the ANC, professional representation.
Yes.
If you've worked in a municipality, you will understand the politics of municipalities are like, wow, you know. So that was, I mean, we would argue, I used to say that we would sit and argue about putting a speed hump at Mitchell's Plain. We'll argue for 1 hour.
Oh,
because
my.
It's like, do we start with that area, or do we paint a wall in C-Point? It was like, I mean, really, some of the things we used to sit and just, I said, Nieman, let me go.
for people who have not worked in government, can you share with us a secret? They're not listening, people in government. If there's one thing that people don't know about working in a municipality or in government, what would be that one secret?
Funny enough, because I've worked in a municipality and I was seconded to Department of Labor later, which is national government.
Yeah.
That is the part of government I enjoy the most.
Oh,
and I'll
explain why.
Municipality is different, okay? Because as opposed to national government, in national government, there's a minister, director general, and then the senior leadership.
Yes.
And you do what you need to do. You look at your mandate, you do what you do.
Yeah.
With municipalities, you've got the city council. You've got a council meeting where all the politicians and the opposition parties, whatever, have to sit there. And you, as the management, you can't decide on your own like you would decide when you are in other arms of government.
Yeah.
So for me personally, working in national government was way better. I was able to execute and use my skill and my knowledge better. Sometimes I found that in a municipality, it had nothing to do with what you know.
Yeah.
It had nothing to do with whether you're a hard worker.
Yeah.
There was a lot of politics.
Yeah.
Which I felt that you have to navigate this. It's almost like taking away from the work that I've been doing.
Yeah. That makes sense. So would you say that's the highlight of your career? That's the high point, being at national?
Yes, actually. Yeah. And the highlight definitely for me was working for Department of Labor. At that time, our minister was Tito Mboweni. And, you know, I worked under Sipho Phetshana, who was our director general. And why I was saying was a highlight because it was during President Mandela's presidency. It was a highlight because we had to come with all the pieces of legislation that had to transform South Africa. Basic conditions of employment, Employment Equity Act, Labor Relations Act, you know, the UIF, to put that together. We had to put, you know, if you look at the CCMA now, we had to do all the planning of establishing what is called the CCMA. There were so many things that were the first. We were doing a lot of things, and we worked hard. You know, when people say that people in government are lazy, I don't think I agree with that.
Who's in the leadership?
But in my time, with the people I worked with, we worked so hard because we have to develop the draft policy. You know, that piece of legislation, you have to go and present it in government. You have to motivate, fight for it. You have to go and do research as to, like, for example, when you put together the Employment Equity Act, you don't just sit on your own. You have to visit different countries and see where did it work, where did it fail, what do we have to put in there. So I was heading human resources at that time, and it was a lot of work, but I enjoyed it. I learned a lot. It was a stretch.
A Journey of Diversity and Inclusion in South Africa, Guidelines for Leading Inclusively. Tell us a little bit more about this book and how did it come about?
Yeah, it came about because when I worked for Eskom, and as I said, I worked for 10 years for Eskom. And Eskom, if there's one organization that was great with developing its staff, was Eskom. I was sent for a study period. There were short study periods in the U.S. In an organization that the head of that department was doing work on diversity. At the time, it wasn't like that well known. And I tend to enjoy what she was doing. And I was sort of studying here for a while. It wasn't even a short visit. I think it was about 4 weeks or something. And then I came back home and I told my manager that, wow, I enjoyed what I learned. Can you allow me? And he was very kind. He said, whatever you've learned, implement. You know, the late Bongani Khumalo, I know he died during COVID. I really appreciate the work that you do. So, and then I did work on diversity and inclusion, and I was heading the Employment Equity Department for Eskom. We put together the Employment Equity strategy for Eskom, and we really did a lot of work at that time. And then, you know, I then felt that I've actually gained a lot of knowledge when I left to now go and start my own company. Because while I was at Department of Labor, I was still an Eskom employee. I was paid by Eskom, so I never left Eskom as such. So when I left and I said, can I go start my own company? I then got a scholarship, in fact, by the British Council to go and study in the UK. But then I had thought they'll allow me, and my child was 3 years old or whatever. I thought they'll allow me to bring a child. They said no. I said, oops, you can give it to the next best person. So I didn't go. But you know when they say God knows? You know when they said, you don't know, eye has seen, no ear has seen. When you don't know what God has planned for you. Because when it was painful to let go of that scholarship. But then during that period, I then joined a consulting company just for a short period, thinking I'm preparing to go to the UK. And then I started then. It happened to be the company that's also consulting on diversity. And then, yeah, I enjoyed it. I liked it. When I decided I'm not going, I then stayed in this company. And, you know, I can tell you this. Please, whoever is listening, can you? We need to believe. When God say, I like it, you know, people in my church know, I always say, can you claim the scripture that is in the Bible? Claim it and live it. Because I remember looking at the owner of the company. She was a Jewish woman. And I said, one day, because I thought I'm just in transition, I said, one day I want to own a company like this, not knowing that I'll actually own it. I used to Say it with my mouth. Say it with my mouth. So after a few years, I was able to buy her out. She
yes.
left to go to live in Australia.
Yeah.
And now I'm the sole owner of the company, which really has grown leaps and bounds. Praise be to God. Then when I looked at that journey, I said, I need to document this.
Yes.
I need to document this because there's so many stories of challenges. Even when I worked in the power stations of Eskom during the migrant labor system, what was happening there was really painful. So I documented all of that and I put it in a book. And let me tell you why I was saying when people are the younger ones, because me, my age now, I'm looking up to those that are young, okay? To say that, you know, when you document something, there is nothing that irritates me like, we used to say, in Soweto, we used to say that Americans would come here and then after 3 months, they write a book about Soweto.
Yes, ne? Yes.
But who stops you from writing it?
No one.
Wena. No, Canaan, there's no police officer that says you can't write a book about a country if you visited for 3 weeks.
Exactly.
It's not illegal.
Yeah.
You can do that.
Yeah.
So yes, people would come here and write a whole thing about Soweto. And they've just been here for 3 weeks.
Sure.
Let me, instead of criticizing other people, let me write my story.
Yeah.
Because one thing about a book, it's your story.
Yes.
You know, nobody can say, if it's your story, as long as you say the truth, because there'll be people who say, no, Nini's lying. She never worked for Eskom.
Yeah.
So you must just document the truth, right? But I'm saying it's your story. So and you feel that you've shared, you know, if I tell you how many letters I get from young people who are saying, you know, go chapter mang, what you've written there, I'm going through that now. And I published this book a while ago and I'm still getting people now because it's still selling even now.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's amazing. I'm still going through that in the workplace. So by documenting our experiences and giving people hope. Okay, you are actually, it's almost like spreading the gospel, right?
Yeah.
Because book travels further than you can.
Yes.
I am currently, it's a prescribed book for University of Denver, Colorado, for their elective first year students. So every year, they gather all of them who studied. They know the book more than me. You know, they'll say, okay, I was looking at chapter 9. Nako, I've forgotten what is in chapter 9. But anyway, so they get all the students and then they can ask me anything about South Africa, about the book, and they really feel that it helps them because the title says Diversity in South Africa, the contents of the book are just global.
Sure.
Right? It's a global piece of work. And I'm encouraging whoever is, maybe there are people who started writing, please finish that book. A book will amaze you.
Yeah.
It will travel because when I asked a Colorado, how did you get hold of me? They said one of their professors was traveling to Denmark.
Yeah.
He was on a plane and he was sitting next to somebody who was reading my book.
Ooh.
And he looked at it and he looked at the cover. He took a picture. He went back, bought it at Amazon. They read it and they decided, let's prescribe it. Can you see?
Imagine.
I was totally far away thing. So, If you have a story, please tell it.
Please write it down.
Write your book.
Sure. What a way to start there. I told you, like, you know, you're starting on a really high note. We've got about a few minutes, but I want to ask this question, which I think is very important. How would you define your relationship with money, chelete?
Yo. I have this standing belief.
Yeah.
You know when at church we do offertory call, I like using this demonstration because I'm very visual.
Yeah.
I like using this demonstration of a river.
Okay.
Ne? That, and I say it with my mouth because I would claim a scripture and I would say it and I'll say it with my mouth that, you know, money flows through me effortlessly.
Ooh.
I say it. As much as it will sound, you see, one of the things that for me are unfortunate, there are some people in our church who feel as if the word prosperity or money is a sin.
Mm.
It's like, you shouldn't be saying that. Mm. Who said that?
Yeah.
Okay, if you look at the Bible, there are so many scriptures that talk about. So I believe, and I would say money flows through me effortlessly.
Sure.
It's like a river. There is a picture of a river and a pond.
Yeah.
If you are a pond, a pond has algae. The water doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Whereas a river, water goes, as it flows through, God puts more, as long as you will also give others,
yes,
right? So it's a flowing process.
Yeah.
And a river, if you put your hands on this for water to flow, they will never be dry, okay? So my relationship with money is that you cannot hoard, okay?
Yeah.
God wants you to open your hands, and he will give you, you give others, you make an impact, you make a difference in life, and he will continue to give that to you. I do not want to be a pond. I do not want to create algae next to my life. So my relationship with money, and I also teach my kids, I say, for example, they've started a business together, and I said to them, can we sit down and talk about money before you make money first? Can you have a conversation about money mindset before money comes in? Because that's where people go wrong. People who start businesses, like in partnerships, they don't discuss those issues of money. Once the first payment comes in, that's where you see people's personalities. So you need to actually know that when God says he will bless you, believe it. As long as where he has given you, give others as well.
Sure, that's beautiful. Sure. For people who want the book, where can I get it? I think it's definitely one to add to my collection as well.
Yes.
Where can people get the book? Where can I go to get the book?
On my website, it's cheaper. It's at Amazon, but it is slightly more expensive.
Yeah.
On my website, which is the normal www. If you just type Mandate Mulifi, you'll get to my website. The very first page,
this
book, if you want to buy it.
Yes.
And
that's
cheaper there.
Yeah.
But you can also buy it from Amazon.
From Amazon as well. There are young people who are listening, ma'am. They want to be where you are in the next coming few years or so.
Yes.
And they follow your journey. Maybe some are listening from Colorado as we speak.
Yes.
You know? Any final thoughts to them? The year is starting. Where would you say they should pick their mind?
Yes. You know, for me, I just say, let's say you are employed, right? And I know that not everybody's employed, but let me talk firstly about whether you're employed or you're at university, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever work or job that lands in your hands, when you do it, can you do it to the level of excellence?
Yeah.
So that, and you know, it happens all the time. If you do your job excellently, do you know that people will notice? They will notice.
Yeah.
Always work hard.
Yeah.
So that when there's time for promotion, rather, there would not even be a doubt that so-and-so is ready for promotion. So for me, sometimes, you know, in the work that I do of diversity, whenever people talk about a glass ceiling, you know, sometimes I've met people who say, who've got a glass bottom.
Sure.
You know, a glass bottom, well, this job is too low for me. And that, for me, that's where we go wrong. We should say, yes, this is my role. But if there's something else to be done, jump. If there's photocopy to be done, jump. Show that you are there.
Yeah.
You are making a difference.
Yeah.
And I employ people in my company.
Yeah.
And for me, those are the people I employ.
Yes.
I just observe you, you might not last.
Yes.
But when I see somebody going an extra mile, it is real. It's not just cliche.
Yes.
People who walk an extra mile make it in life. And most importantly, please read.
Please read.
Constantly read.
Yeah.
Never forget to improve yourself.
Ma'am, this is part one. My producer is listening. So definitely this is part one. There's still a lot to unpack and just share from your journey as well, which I think is worth sharing with our listeners and myself as well. And definitely want to get myself that book as well. But what a way
to
start the year. Thank you so much for joining
us
this evening. And God continue to bless you.
Oh, yes. Thank you. The Lord has really blessed throughout my life. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, ma'am. Have a good evening.
Okay, then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.